My first job out of college was writing Sunday school lessons for middle school kids, which actually was not a bad gig, but the company had this tremendous expectation that you whatever lesson you developed would lead to no complaint letters, even though there were tens of thousands of different churches from all different kinds of traditions reading this. And in fact, what would happen is they would have somebody from the management wing bring the complaint letter down to the editorial wing and pin it up on this big bulletin board. It's kind of the wall of shame. So all that became a real problem one day when I and some others on this editorial team sat down in the conference room and looked ahead to the next quarter that we were supposed to develop lessons for, and we saw this text from John 2. Jesus made a whip from some ropes and chased them all out of the temple. He drove out the sheep and cattle, scattered the money changers' coins over the floor, flipped over their tables, and then going over to the people who sold doves, he said, "Get these things out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a marketplace." So there was silence. Somebody's like, "Can we skip it?" Well, no, it is in all four Gospels. I guess, you know, if you want to deal with Jesus, that's what you get. And we're like, "Oh, well, what do we do with it? Like, it's not like Jesus makes a craft project. He makes a whip. It looks like a barroom brawl. Tables are flying, animals are bellowing. You can hear the whip cracking in the air. And this man with a red face, I assume, maybe veins bulging in his neck, is like, "Get these out of here." We're like, "Oh, well, what do we tell the impressionable minds of a 12-year-old to do?" So here's what we came up with. When Jesus got angry, his anger was under control, which you can tell because it took him time to sit and make the whip. Okay. Well, that may be well true, but it completely misses the question. And I don't want us to miss it. So I want to press in tonight and ask that. Why? Why would Jesus make and use a whip? Why would Jesus, who taught, turn the other cheek, go a second mile, forgive? Why would he do something so incredibly forceful and destructive, or at least disruptive? I imagine they were able to put the tables back together. So that is a big why. I want to try to answer it tonight, because if we can do that, then we can try to answer, well, then how does it apply to you and me? We say we're following in the footsteps of Jesus Christ. In what way do we follow in this footstep right here? Well, let me point out three things that Jesus sees that bother him. John 2, verse 13, if you want to turn there in your gospel, says it was nearly time for the Jewish Passover celebration. That's the spring. So Jesus went to Jerusalem. This, every spring, every Jew is called to go up to Jerusalem to worship. This is their high holy days. This is like our Holy Week. And you worship the Holy One of Israel. Jerusalem, which would have been about the size of Wheaton, 50, 60,000 people, swells to like 300,000 to 400,000 people. So imagine that in Wheaton. You know, the city's completely packed. And everybody's heading for the temple, which is by far the biggest building, the most important building, the grandest building in the city. Jesus goes up along with them, and when he steps into the temple courts, which is like kind of like the outer plaza before you get into the inner courts of the temple, it's like 20 football fields. So it's enormous. Like it'd be like sort of like the parking lot outside of Soldier Field or something. I mean, it would feel kind of like that. And when he walks in to pray, what he smells is the musky smell of animals. Animal dung. Straw. Vendors yelling, "Cheapest pigeons in the city." You can hear coins clink. It's very hard to pray. It's like going to a cathedral to pray, and you walk in, and they're like, souvenirs, taco plate, you know, whatever. And you're like, this is crazy. Now, all those animals used to be outside the temple. They were across the Kidron Valley and up along the slopes of the Mount of Olives. But 9 years prior, Caiaphas, the high priest, who's the only one who can determine these kind of things, had moved them into the temple area. Much more convenient for people. Let's make this much more convenient for them, and it's going to help them fulfill what Moses commanded, where you offer, there's no worship without sacrifice. We know that. So when we come to worship, we offer a sacrifice of praise and a sacrifice of financial giving of, according to our means. And so the folks then offered up something valuable like a bull or a lamb, which was very valuable in their culture. And if you can't afford those, then a pair of doves in a wicker basket. Those are the only option for the poor, are the doves, and they're especially chosen by both the poor and by women who usually are poorer. And so that's what Jesus' mom has always done, is the pair of doves, and probably what Jesus would offer himself. Now, if you got to travel a long way, you're not going to bring your animal with you. You're going to bring money, and you're going to buy an animal once you get there. But get this, get some idea how much price gouging was going on here. Shortly after the time of Jesus, a rabbi declared that the price of animals purchased for sacrifice in a temple, they had to lower the price by 99%. 99% off. So let's say that in the time of Jesus, when he walks up there, there's $600 for a pair of doves. Now it's $6. Okay, so Jesus sees that to worship God, these poor people, mostly women, are having to cough up $600 they don't have. So the first thing Jesus sees that bothers him are sales in the wrong place, where it should be free for prayer, and at the wrong price. It's extortionate. The poor are coming to pray, and they're getting absolutely financially buried. Well, the second thing he sees, verse 14, he sees dealers at tables exchanging foreign money. And what's going on here? The law of Moses says that every male of Israel, to redeem your soul, you give half a shekel annually. It's called the temple tax. And paying that is fine. Jesus himself pays the temple tax. But why can't people pay in whatever currency they bring with them? Why does there have to be like a currency exchange? Well, I'd originally read that that was because worshipers were often coming with Roman coins or Greek coins, which had images of the Roman emperor who believed himself to be divine or other things. And so that was blasphemous. So you had to convert that into Jewish money in the temple. I've even said that in a sermon. But I dug a little deeper this week and I found out that's not the whole story. Because the currency exchange here would allow you to bring in and actually encourage you to bring in shekels from Tyre, which is along the Mediterranean coast. And what is on those coins? The Phoenician god Melkart, aka Baal. You talk about a blasphemous image. Now, why are those coins fine? Because they're at least 94% pure silver, whereas the Roman coins are only about 80% silver. Get it? Now the currency exchange dynamic starts to really make sense. Like, if you've traveled overseas, you know, if I stop in the airport and I exchange, I'm going to get killed, right? It'd be better to find a bank and do it, you know, somewhere else. But here, when you come to worship God, you're actually getting double killed. You're not only getting killed on the exchange rate, you're getting killed because your bill reads 80% silver, but has to be paid in 94% silver. One more time, poor people are coming up there to worship God and they're going home more desperate than they were. All right, so number one, he sees these animal sales in the wrong place and at the wrong price. And then he sees this currency exchange, which is double hitting the poor. And then number three, Jesus looks around at the people in the temple. And here's some of the people he notices. And remember, by the way, people are being taxed already by the Romans to the point where one bad harvest and they're done. So, but it says, while Jesus was in the temple, he watched the rich people dropping their gifts in the collection box. And then a poor widow came by and dropped in two small coins, a couple quarters maybe. I tell you the truth, Jesus says, this poor widow's given more than what everybody else is giving because they've given a tiny part of their surplus. She's given everything. She just took her net worth down to zero, from 50 cents to zero. And where's her money going? This is the question. Follow the money, as they say. Okay. The temple is the national bank. So the Sadducees and Pharisees who oversee the temple are making boku dollars off this whole thing. Ancient historian Josephus calls Annas the high priest a great hoarder up of money. So the high priest family is doing great. Pharisees, great. Sadducees, great. And then what do those guys do? They walk around the temple in really nice embroidered robes with extra wide boxes on their arms to hold scripture verses and extra long tassels to show how devoted they are at prayer. And those robes, which look so fantastic, are paid for off the backs of the poor. And that's why Jesus is head explodes, and he goes, my house shall be called a house of prayer, and you've made it a den of robbers. Now, what happens when, not if, this poor worshiper who just had to pay $600 for a pair of doves, but she wanted to do it for the Lord, had two coins left over, put that in the offering plate, and then she gets in financial trouble, which of course she will. And she needs to beg for a loan. Where does she go to get one? The only people who have the money, the bankers at the temple, right? But the interest rates are so high that some people wind up losing the only collateral they had to put up for the loan, their house, and they end up losing their house, which is why Jesus in one place calls out people who shamelessly cheat widows out of their property and then pretend to be pious by making long prayers in public. Because of this, they'll be severely punished. Jesus is not having any of this whole system. And it's in the name of God. Now, friends, over the past few years, we have seen in America major Christian leaders caught in scandals. If I started down the list, you would recognize a number of the names because many of them are even in Chicago here. Okay? Now, since then, their ministries have radically downsized or whatever, whatever, but like, think of Ravi Zacharias or Bill Hybels or James McDonald. Now you go, what's going on? Well, here's my opinion. In every case, there was extravagance. There was a reason why this leader's gifts were so special. They needed the private jet. They needed this and that, of course, right? And then there were expenses off the books, double books. There was hush money, all that kind of stuff. And I believe Jesus has been picking up the whip. And he's driving out those unholy and profane things from the people of God. And he's like, you're building this ministry off the backs of poor people sending you donations because they love God and they love his word. All that's got to get out of the Father's house. Everything. It is the burning passion of Jesus Christ to protect the poor, to guard the honor of the Father and the dignity of the poor. So when Jesus sees rich people getting richer at the expense of poor people getting poorer, and it's all in the name of God, he picks up a whip. He's not having it. Then, he drove out the sheep and cattle. And then he said, get these things out of here. Stop turning my Father's house into a marketplace. And Mark adds, he did one more thing. he stopped everyone from using the temple as a marketplace and carrying stuff through. He stood there with the whip and said, no, 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 no sales today. He put an embargo on it. Now, Jesus knows what he is doing. He is cutting off the flow of money into those leaders' wallets. And he has the gall to act like he's got the authority to do that and the authority to dictate what happens in the temple, which only the high priest had. And those leaders, they feel so much rage toward Jesus right now, they could murder him. And the only problem they have to work out is, how do we get near him? Because the crowds love him. Okay. Well, they take 30 pieces of silver, yes, shekels from Tyre, 94% or higher, pure silver, and they use it to hire an informant. And within 1 week, Jesus is dead. Now, how do you and I apply this today? It is a basic, fundamental part of the God-honoring life that we give to the poor. We must protect the poor. We must speak up for them as we can. We must try to help relieve their burdens. This is all, you could just read the Old Testament, and it's so clear, but when Jesus comes, he takes it to a whole new level. He's born poor. His mom is doing the pair of doves. He lives poor. He dies owning nothing but the clothes on his back. Let's call that net worth $20. And that gets stolen from him. And then Jesus keeps telling stories where the person who's living a comfortable life ends up being called you fool. Or suffering in flames. Take that one. While the person struggling financially ends up feasting at God's banquet table. And in case we can't understand his stories, he just comes right out and says, woe to you who are rich, blessed are you who are poor. So from the earliest days of Christianity, Christians have identified with and taken up the cause of those who have less, of those who are struggling, of those who are down on their luck, of those who are despised. One of my favorite ones is named Lawrence. When he was 32 years old, he was named archdeacon, or which is like lead deacon, in the city of Rome, which meant it was his job to take care of the church's finances and the distributions to the poor. Okay? Unfortunately for Lawrence, the very next year after he gets this job, the Roman Emperor Valerian sends out a decree that all bishops, priests, and deacons must be rounded up and killed. They catch up to his bishop, Sixtus, when he's leading a worship service in the catacombs, and they kill him. Then they haul in Lawrence, and they say, well, before we kill you, though, we want you to turn over all the church money. So Lawrence says, okay, just give me 3 days to get everything together. That's a lot to pull together. So they give him 3 days. So he takes, in those 3 days, all the church's money that's left and doles it all out to the poor. So the empire can't get it. And it goes where it was going to go anyway. And then on his day to show up before the governor, he walks in with a group of people. One guy's leaning on a crutch. Another one's lost almost all his teeth. Another one, you can tell he's been sleeping out on the streets. And it's just like a whole crowd of people like that. And the governor says, Lawrence, where are the church's valuables? And Lawrence says, here they are. These are the valuables of the church. Now, fast forward to our time and place, and you will find that almost every organization in our county that's designed to help people who are poor was started by Christians. You just go down the list. And I know some of you are working for them. I know some of you, in your own way, are caring for a family member who's poor, and you have very direct care. Some of you are advocating. But you think about, for example, Mary and Joy Rehabilitation Hospital. You're in a motorcycle accident, you got a rehab. That was started by Franciscan sisters. World Relief was founded by the National Association of Evangelicals. And why do they advocate for fair immigration policies? A lot of it is because the poor, the way the poor are being treated. Outreach ministries started by evangelicals with a social concern. People's Resource Center, which we're supporting with this year's Good Friday gift, that was started by Catholics who were inspired by like Martin Luther King Jr. and Dorothy Day and Jane Addams. And they said, you know what, we should start a food pantry. So in 1975, they rented this little house in Wheaton and recruited their friends and neighbors to each bring grocery bags to start the food pantry. Well, as you know, they outgrew that little rented house and then got their own building, but now they're outgrowing that. And you can see the construction if you go behind the courthouse, old courthouse building, just north of Four Brothers Chocolates. And according to Debbie Dudek from People's Resource, she said, the new walk-in cooler, which our Good Friday gift will support, is one of the most important appliances in the new building. She said, it allows us to offer our neighbors healthy food options, fresh milk, eggs, dairy. She explained to me that they cut up a lot of fruit and put it in containers. So that you need a walk-in cooler to store all that so that you can provide fresh fruit to people. And I had no idea, but she said every year they serve 25,000 of our neighbors in need in DuPage County. And that's 37% more clients than the year before. You think, oh, we're past COVID, you know, food is abundant. Uh-huh. Okay. Friends, it is our call to follow the Master in our own ways, however small, to think about what life is like for them, to take up their cause, to relieve the poor where we can, to protect them. You know, the only reason why there's actually like affordable housing in Wheaton is because of those Franciscan nuns who run Mary and Joy. I noticed that they just took that old rundown hotel kind of across from Trader Joe's in Glen Ellen, and there was a consortium that came together to provide affordable housing units in there, which I'm very pleased to see. And as you would expect, there was a lot of blowback from neighbors, you know, even though that's Roosevelt Road, right? I mean, your neighbor is Wingstop, right? But, you know, oh, this is going to bring down property values. Well, who's going to speak up? Jesus did, and he invites us. So this Good Friday, when you come to worship, this is an opportunity for us. Bring something that fits. Bring something that expresses your heart. No guilt, no pressure, but an invitation that this is one simple way we can do our following of the Lord in this. Amen.